Congresswoman Lemon, you are good to go.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I mean, Madam Clerk, I apologize. I was just notified by Madam Speaker that she will be. She's wonderful. Thank you.
Sorry, I was trying to get in through my laptop and I couldn't, so I'm just calling in for now until I get it set up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to call the Osage Nation Health and Social Services Committee meeting to order. The time is 1:03 p.m. The first item on our agenda is prayer. I'd like to invite Congresswoman Shaw to say an afternoon prayer for us.
She'll be happy to. Please bow your heads. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this day. Thank you for bringing us together to do good work for the Osage Nation, Lord. Please guide us as we do so. Lord, there's so much sorrow and sickness during this time. Please keep our members safe. Take care of our children and our elders and keep this virus away from us, Lord. We thank you for all the blessings you've bestowed upon us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Congresswoman Shaw, for your lovely evening. Attached to the meeting invite, go through the minutes. Actually, I need to back up. I apologize. Thank you, Speaker Pratt. We didn't do a roll call to verify that we have a quorum. So, Madam Speaker, if I need to back up, I mean, Madam Clerk. Madam Clerk, are you there?
Sorry about that.
Okay, thank you.
Congresswoman Stabler.
Present.
Congressman Big Horse. Congresswoman Goodfox.
Present.
Speaker Pratt.
Present.
Congressman Tillman.
Here.
Congresswoman Lemon.
Present. We do have a quorum, so thank you very much for being here today. Now we do have the minutes to look over. If the committee would please take time to look over the minutes.
Chair, this is Stabler.
Yes, ma'am.
Under the attendees, I think Paul Fragua, his name is misspelled. And I looked it up and I think it's Fragua.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair, this is Stabler. I move to approve the minutes as amended.
There's a motion on the floor and a second from Congresswoman Good.
Yes.
Do I hear any opposed? Hearing none, the minutes from 12-2-2020 have been approved. Thank you, committee. Moving on to the agenda, well, first I'd like to welcome everyone. I see that we have Dr. Shaw, Mr. Kirk Shaw, and the board chair, Ms. Shangru, in attendance. Oh, and also Ms. Laura Sawney with the clinic. I thank you very much for being here today. And if the Madam Clerk could please note that who's in attendance today, I would greatly appreciate that on the minutes, for the minutes to reflect that. I did hear from Congressman Big Horse. Are you here with us now, sir?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Congressman Big Horse, for joining us today. Okay. So the next item on our agenda is the Moss Adams report that we received, I believe, about September 16th of 2020. And it is a report that talks about the reorganization or restructuring and management done by a consultant of Moss Adams. And so I would just invite Ms. Shangru to maybe give us a little bit of information on how this came to be, or what we're, you know, where, how we got to where we are with the particular report that we have in front of us, and then go from there, if that's all right with the committee.
Chair, I believe you skipped an item.
Oh, I did. You guys, please, I do apologize. COVID vaccine update, which we received via email. Thank you, Vice Chair. I appreciate that. So that we received an email from Dr. Shaw and Laura Sawney yesterday. And I hope everyone was able to review it. And so, Dr. Shaw, thank you very much for sending the plan to us. And if you'd like, I'd open the floor to you, and then we can have discussion following your presentation.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I need to bring the vaccine. Give us just a moment to get there. We go. Okay. So, as you are probably now aware, there are two COVID vaccines that have received emergency use authorization from the FDA. They are both these messenger RNA type vaccines, first of their type to actually be authorized to be used in the populations for which they're designed for. I think it's age 16 and above for Pfizer, age 18 and above for the Moderna vaccine. The clinic has received this week doses of both vaccines. We've been vaccinating since the week before last, and to date have vaccinated somewhere around 85 patients. We have a tent erected on the east side of the clinic that has a negative pressure airflow capability, has heat and air as needed, to where we can not only vaccinate but observe these patients for 15 minutes after vaccination, observing for any allergic reactions. Just taking this from the top here, we talk about vaccine availability. When it was drafted, we didn't yet have either one. Now we have both. We did get our first allocation of Pfizer. We've had two allocations of Pfizer and got our first Moderna allocation this week for 200 doses. And so the way we got our vaccine, which is through the Indian Health Service, is that in early October, we were asked to compile a pre-planning tool that consisted of providing numbers of our healthcare personnel, tribal members that resided in long-term care facilities, critical essential employees for the Osage Nation, and then elders greater than 65, including those who have comorbid medical conditions like heart or lung disease, immunosuppressed status, diabetes, obesity. So there's several of those comorbid conditions. And so that number I sent at that time was 3,000. And so that's what IHS is using to determine our allocation. Now, we've not gotten 3,000 because they didn't get enough to give everyone their to meet the amount requested in the pre-planning tool. And so what I was told is during this first 4 weeks that we'll receive enough likely to only be able to vaccinate our healthcare personnel. All of our healthcare personnel, however, have not agreed to accept the vaccine. And so we vaccinated those who elected to receive it. We have one or two every day who changed their mind. And so we continue to vaccinate those healthcare personnel. But I'll go more into that when we get down to the prioritization. As you may have seen, people who look at the internet on COVID may have seen the CDC has its own recommendations regarding who should be in priority groups. There's universal agreement about phase 1A should be healthcare workers. Then the most recent iteration had residents of long-term care facilities sort of be in a similar level of priority. Then next, the CDC had critical essential employees and then had that group subdivided into different, in other words, some people were more critical or essential than others in that large group. And then their third priority group was people greater than 75, and before that it was age 65, so that was a recent change. So let's say age greater than 65 with and without these medical comorbidities. And that constituted the phase one highest priority vaccinees. We have vaccinated all the healthcare workers so far who've wanted to be vaccinated. And then long-term care residents, we reached out to Osage tribal members who reside in any of the three nursing homes in Osage County. And surprisingly, we've had very few reach back out to us saying that they want us to bring the vaccine. We heard that the Fairfax Nursing Home had CVS Pharmacy Services bringing out, I believe it was last Wednesday, vaccine for the residents of that nursing home. So we sort of stood down on that because vaccine was apparently coming and or the others were not wanting us to bring the vaccine out to the nursing home. So we're still available. We even published on our website, our Facebook site, to family members of elders who reside in those nursing homes. Please contact us if they're interested in getting the vaccine. That we'll bring the vaccine out to where they reside and vaccinate. It may be that the state's plan to vaccinate all patients in nursing homes may be addressing that. We have the age greater than 65 rated above the essential employees, as you may see on that. I discussed this with the chief in detail, as well as my staff, and we felt like with the regard we have for elders in Osage culture, that they should be at a higher priority status than the essential employees. So you'll see how that's different from the CDC guidelines. And the Indian Health Service made it clear that we're able to establish and set our own guideline priorities. In other words, we don't have to match in lockstep the CDC's guidelines. So we had one change there. Phase two is when we get a large number of doses available, and that may very well be in late spring, to where we can start vaccinating the general population, you know, the otherwise healthy 30-year-old, 25-year-old who really doesn't have any comorbid conditions. And that's when we're looking at having mass immunization events out in the community. Meanwhile, we're centralized here at the clinic. Part of it was because the Pfizer vaccine has very stringent storage requirements that made it difficult to transport out of the community. So vaccine distribution and ordering coming from the Indian Health Service, there will come a time soon we can order directly from McKesson and Pfizer. In the meantime, we're getting the vaccine at no cost from the Indian Health Service. But in return for that, we agreed to submit data regarding our vaccination efforts so that the CDC data warehouse can keep track of how many we're vaccinating and even following them up for adverse effects. Giving the vaccine are selected members of the nursing staff, who are RNs, and then trained pharmacy staff. We've always used some of the pharmacists to even give influenza vaccines on a seasonal basis. So our pharmacists are well trained to be able to provide this vaccine. The data management, which means the data entering we have to provide that goes to the CDC. We have two designated members who enter that data directly into our electronic health record. And then the safety and monitoring, we have a hotline to which people are encouraged to report side effects, but there is a app made for smartphones that the CDC has made available free of charge that we are promoting called V-Safe. And in the tent is the picture of the
QR code.
Yeah, the QR code that you can scan and actually import the app into your phone, and it will contact you every day to check in and ask about side effects. It takes about 10 seconds to complete and you're done. And then the CDC gets this data and is able to monitor for side effects. It's really a safety and side effect monitoring tool called V-Safe. And again, we've got one of the medical tents up. We did just put up the second medical tent to actually start seeing COVID patients in. You know, we had a medical tent up in the spring early on, but we actually didn't have much volume then. We saw very few in that medical tent. We took it down in late May because we simply didn't need it then, and now we've purchased two tents. And so we put both of them up now, one for the vaccination efforts and one for actually seeing COVID patients. If we look at going down to vaccination protocol, we use this master list to be able to not only offer the vaccine to healthcare personnel, but also to the elders who have comorbidities and those who do not. We are using age 65, not 75. And we had discussed those, and they arrived at in conjunction with discussion with the executive branch. People, if they change their mind and don't want it, and then 2 weeks later want to get it, they are still that's made available to them. If we have both available, we are both those vaccines are available to any particular individual who wants a specific vaccine. If we happen to have it in inventory, frankly, I don't think there's a real convincing reason to prefer one over the other in general. There are some minor differences between the two, but with regard to safety, I'm not sure that that's actually been proven enough to where someone should favor one over the other. But we have people who want the Moderna vaccine. I think the storage requirements for the Pfizer vaccine gave it a little bit of a black eye, and so people were not trusting with it because it was so difficult to store. It's two shots. There's day 1 and 21 for Pfizer, day 1 and 28 for Moderna. And so we follow these patients, we schedule them for their next vaccine so that they're able to keep track of that. And that V-Safe app actually also reminds them when they're due for their second vaccine. And you've got really a 4-day window before or after their scheduled date to be able to get the second vaccination shot. And like I said, we do monitor them. We have epinephrine available for anyone that would have an allergic reaction like anaphylaxis. We have standing orders authorized to use that. We have an emergency kit, including intravenous fluids, steroids, and Benadryl to give to supplement the epinephrine that we have available. And I think that's the run through that I wanted to express today. I would say probably the biggest topic that relates to the vaccine has to do with priority groups and how do people who are not in the priority groups, how do they get scheduled? And as far as the second question, the people that are not in any of those priority groups, we're not able to schedule them right now. We don't have the vaccine for that group as of yet. And it may very well be mid to late spring before we have enough vaccine allocated to us to where we can do that. As soon as we can purchase vaccine, we plan to do that to supplement our allocation from IHS. But right now, you can't even purchase it directly. So, Madam Chair, that's my presentation. Willing to answer questions.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw, for your presentation. And committee, if you have any questions for Dr. Shaw or or anyone else on the committee and any other members of Congress concerning the information that Dr. Shaw has provided us. Okay, I just have a couple of questions I'm interested in learning about, more about the vaccine and some of the ways that, a couple of things here. Dr. Shaw, I see you requested 3,000 is what you had said. So does that mean that it would be 6,000 doses of the Moderna or Pfizer?
Yes, 6,000. Enough to vaccinate 3,000 people. I may have said 3,000 doses. If I did, I misspoke. It's 3,000 times two. So it would be 6,000 total doses. They don't all come in at the same time, but we've been assured that sufficient vaccine will be coming our way to be able to vaccinate these people in follow-up for either one of those. So we're relying on the IHS's assurances for that, and we should get 6,000 total dosages if they allocate for all of our needs.
Okay. So can I just present a scenario? Because I remember that you said a few moments ago that there's a four-day window. On that four-day window, is that before the four-day window, where does it apply? Before the 21 or 28 days is up or after? Or is it, how would you?
25 for the Pfizer and 24 to 32 for the Moderna.
Okay, so it can be 4 days before and 4 days after.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, so whenever a patient comes in to have an injection done, you're scheduling the second appointment within, of course, that window, which is the 21 to 28, of course, with the 4 days on either side of 21 and 28. So I'm just curious about when we have the possibility, which I really hope this never happens, that someone misses their window. What is the recommendation then?
We'll still vaccinate even late, although we can't assure the patient of the same level of protection as was achieved in the clinical trials. We've heard of 94.5, 94, 95% efficacy in preventing COVID-19 illness. If your vaccine is delayed sufficiently outside that window, you may not have the same antibody response and the same level of protection. So that's the only caveat I could add for someone who's a late second timer. And the other piece is, if your first shot is from Pfizer, your second shot should be from Pfizer, and likewise for Moderna.
And on these, thank you, sir. So they will get the second vaccination that they were to get. It just may not have the desired effects that we would hope is my, okay. So my next question is, are we seeing an increase? Well, actually, I'm going to go to a different part. So we have the vaccine plan and it has the priorities on there. And so, and I understand, and you answered another question I had, will it be available for private purchase, and do we plan on doing that? And so thank you for answering, for, you know, being ahead of that for me. Being that you're getting your doses from IHS, I just didn't know if there's a possible collaborative effort for folks to know if other clinics are receiving vaccines in a larger amount that they could utilize in a different clinic possibly. Or,
well, I know that we have some patients who have charts both here and at Pawnee. I would think that person could probably go to either clinic to get a vaccine. I think they should stick with the same clinic to get both. So in that way, too. Now, could they go to the state health department and possibly get vaccinated? Yes. Let's suppose you were Osage tribal member, but you didn't work for the nation. You worked for a private business in Tulsa. You know, if you were 65 or more employee, you're still eligible as a tribal member to get vaccine from us, but it also might be made available to you through another mechanism in Tulsa, such as through the state health department. The state gets its vaccine allocation, and then the tribes get our vaccine allocation. And so I think we're all trying to be a little miserly with our vaccine right now because we don't have enough to vaccinate everyone as quick as we would like. And so, like, for example, these nursing homes, I've told my staff, I would love to be able to reach out and vaccinate everyone in that nursing home, but I also know that they are in the state health department's jurisdiction, and the health department is reaching out to vaccinate residents of nursing homes. So if that allows us to conserve doses to treat our elders and go a little further as the allocation continues, that that's how we use this shared jurisdiction approach.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw. Basically, I was wanting to...
I have a question.
Oh, yes. Who is that, Congresswoman Rebard?
No, it's Alice.
Oh, I apologize. Yes, Congresswoman Goodfox, you have the floor.
Thank you. Hi, Dr. Shaw. So I was wondering about the vaccines in terms of different vaccines and how, if there needs to be a like a window where you, like so many days before you get the COVID vaccine. So I know a lot of people are getting the flu vaccine still. Some people are, due to their diabetes, are getting the flu vaccine and the pneumonia vaccine, and also they want the COVID vaccine. Do you have to space any of these out, or can you get them all within the same day, or how does that work?
14-day window between vaccines. So it'd be a standalone COVID vaccine, either 14 days after a flu shot, for example, or 14 days before the flu shot. That's the CDC and ACIP recommendation.
Okay, so are we putting that out there for elders with that have pre-existing conditions that want to get the COVID vaccine, that if they haven't already gotten their flu vaccine, that they need to probably get it before the COVID vaccine, or how does that work?
Well, I don't think there's an ideal order of things. I would say that after an influenza vaccine, it's generally said that you won't have protective antibodies for about 2 weeks. But you know, the flu vaccine is not as effective as the early reports on these COVID vaccines. There, you know, last year it was on like 45% or 50% effective. Last year, that's the flu vaccine that's changed its formula and strains, but it's been out for years. Whereas the reports we're getting from Moderna and Pfizer, those early reports were 94% to 95% efficacy. So I've not seen that there is an ideal or preferred sequence. I think if people were available and ready and there was priority groups, I would recommend the COVID vaccine first, and then 14 days later be scheduled to get the flu shot so that they get both done. There is a good reason for being vaccinated against both. It's unfortunate we can't do them both at the same time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw. Just to follow up, whenever you mentioned the question, answered the question for Congresswoman Goodfox, when you're talking about waiting the 14 days, you do mean after the second dose of COVID, after your absolute completion of both doses?
Yes. Well, no, I think it could be first or second. So 14 days between a vaccine, let's put it that way, whether it be the first or second. So the first one, if it's 21 days after the first shot, I guess at day 14, I don't know that this is contraindication to getting a flu shot. Then on day 21, you would still get your second shot then. Because if you don't, you'd have to wait over a month to get your influenza shot. If you're waiting until both injections have been done.
Right. So
just 14 days for either one.
I could see some confusion for myself there.
Right.
And the being is that, well, and I think, you know where I'm going with it is that it's easy for us healthcare workers who live in this every single day to understand that, but to Congresswoman Goodfox's question, I automatically assumed that you would wait until if you receive the Pfizer, just the Pfizer one alone. I mean, just ideally that you would wait until you finish both those vaccines. But at the same time, there's a large window there because there's a 4-day window on each side of those vaccines. We talking about the COVID vaccine. So I could definitely see some, you know, questions on how do we go about this? What's the safest and best way to go about this to receive immunity from flu and COVID?
Well, my recommendation is get the COVID vaccine as soon as you're able. And then 14 days later, get the influenza vaccine and then follow up with your second injection. the reason I pushed the COVID vaccine is it is, first of all, it's deadlier, COVID-19, particularly if you're in one of those priority groups. And COVID vaccines are more effective than the flu vaccine for preventing the illness for which they were designed to prevent. So that's my own personal recommendation. We start with COVID and follow up with the influenza vaccine. We're developing some public service announcements we posted on the our Facebook site and also the Osage Nation's website that will contain answers to questions like these. I appreciate those comments because you're right. It's easy to confuse those. It's pretty darn complex. And there's new things coming out about every 2 or 3 weeks, like these priority groups get adjusted about at least once a month or once every 3 weeks. So we will include the answers to sequencing the flu and the COVID vaccine in our public service announcements.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw. I appreciate that. I was just wondering, too, what are some of the top side effects that we would possibly see from the two vaccines, for anybody who might be listening, some of the top side effects that some people have reported?
Well, they're pretty much, it's almost exactly the same. Probably pain and tenderness and a little swelling at the injection site is the most common. Headache and fatigue and low-grade temperature, all of which are resolved in 24 to 48 hours. You know, when we first started vaccinating, some were concerned, and a few patients, it may be so severe that they would have to miss work. I don't think we've had anybody yet miss work that we know of here at the clinic. I can't say the same for the elders that we've vaccinated, but they tend to be mild, and the one that gets the most press coverage nowadays is anaphylaxis, which is a serious, severe, life-threatening allergic reaction, for which epinephrine is the drug of choice that we have available out there. That's one reason we monitor everyone 15 minutes after the injection, because it's impossible to predict who might get them. It's pretty uncommon to almost rare, but it has happened. We've all heard about it in the news. Someone in the United Kingdom, someone in New York City got anaphylaxis, but we're prepared to treat, and it has a good prognosis if you treat immediately. We're ready for it. We monitor patients, and so that I feel like we're practicing and administering and monitoring in a safe manner. But really, the fatigue, the headache, the lowering temperature, the swelling at the site, I had a little bit of swelling and tenderness at mine, perhaps more than in a flu shot, but it was gone in 36 hours. I never really knew about it unless I pressed on the injection site. So I'm sure there's some people got somewhat sicker than that, but I don't know anyone that's been off work or hospitalized.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw, for giving us that information. Another quick question. So you mentioned earlier about last spring about having the tent, you know, up, and that you thought you'd have a big influx of patients coming in for that. And you didn't see, of course, you know, what you thought you would, which you were prepared, and that's wonderful. Now that you have these other two tents purchased and everything, are you seeing, compared to the last time that you utilized the tent, are we seeing an increase in patients presenting or in patients just coming to be tested even without symptoms? And, you know, what are we doing as far as the protocol on that goes? And the reason I ask this is because we just recently, of course, had Thanksgiving and we had Christmas and we had people gathering, most likely, that they normally, you know, wouldn't have. And I'm just wondering, compared to the last, you know, time that you had the tent up, are you testing folks, you know, that are presenting if they've been closely exposed and they know someone else has been tested positive at one of the gatherings they've been to? Are we just testing for people that are presenting with symptoms?
Well, it's a large number of patients, but the reason why we opened the tent was we're seeing people who had symptoms suspicious for COVID-19. And so they get seen by a provider. Everyone's wearing personal protective equipment or PPE. Almost without exception, those people have a rapid or immediate test done in the clinic. And if necessary, a send-out test can be performed and sent to a reference laboratory. And if they're very suspicious, they may be put in isolation as a presumptive positive until the confirmatory test comes back. So those are symptomatic patients who have symptoms suspicious for COVID. Now, for those people who've just been exposed, and remember, exposure is defined as 6 feet or less away from someone who has known COVID-19 for 15 minutes or more. And it could be cumulative. For the most part, though, it may be a single contact, and that constitutes a close contact. And so if those people want to be tested because they're concerned that they may have it, usually we tell them to be tested at around day seven, 5 to 7, because if you were tested like the same day or the next day after you'd had the close contact exposure, the likelihood, even if you had contracted the virus, that it would be negative that early because you're not shedding enough virus for the test to be positive. But you know, many people are very concerned. They want to be tested right away, although they really can't give you much reassurance because it's so early. So we usually, those people are usually in quarantine. And then they are asked to be tested at day, you know, 5, 6, or 7. So we could, or if they get symptomatic, then test it right away. But if they remain asymptomatic, 5, 6, or 7 to try to determine. And we've changed the quarantine time. You know, it was 14 days across the board. Now it's reduced to 10 days. It's if 7 days, if you get a negative test at day 6 or 7, you can come out on day 8. And then, of course, day 10 on none. And you could stay out 14 still if you wanted to. But, you know, the side effect to contact tracing, all these people with close contacts, is we put a boatload of people in quarantine. And it was for 14 days. And people were off work. They may not work for the nation. They may not get COVID leave. I mean, it was causing an enormous burden just for all these people to be on 14-day quarantine. So the CDC reissued and redefined quarantine guidelines, realizing that to bring people out of quarantine a little early leaves them with a little bit of a residual risk of actually still having COVID-19. So now it's 10 and 7 instead of everyone's 14. So that's helped a little bit. But so if they want to get tested, we try to ask them to wait. If they're symptomatic, we test them right away and maybe get a follow-up test. And right now, if someone's on quarantine, we're asking them all to get tested before they're able to come back to work at the Osage Nation, because there's a significant percentage will become positive, you know, at their seventh day, and they may even not have any symptoms. So a lot of testing. The whole testing is a tremendous undertaking by our staff, because there's so many different scenarios. There's WELA staff, Osage Nation employees, people that are patients but don't work for the Osage Nation. They all have different return to work requirements. We're trying to keep the risk low for Osage Nation employees, but also not force them to be off work excessively. And so it's we are covering all those scenarios. But the biggest change since the spring has been we're probably seeing about 9 times as many patients with COVID symptoms than we were in the spring. You know, we didn't know what was happening in the spring. We were like prepared for the worst, hoping for the best. And the worst never really came until like this fall. And so now it's much busier now than we had the 10th the first time. So that's why we put it back up. And that way we reduce COVID patient flow in and out of the facility and lessen the risk for our employees and other patients who are there for non-COVID related reasons.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw. I wanted to touch on suspicious symptoms when you said symptoms. And the reason I did is because, you know, in researching, you know, there's just been a lot of other types of symptoms that people are experiencing. And I have personal experience with my daughter not following any of the highly suspicious symptoms that are out there for research on the CDC's website. She actually had completely, you know, a pretty much different symptoms than what I suspected. And I suspected that she had a sinus infection, and actually she did not. She actually has COVID. And so I'm just interested in what is considered suspicious symptoms for our population, compared to what you read, can do your research with the CDC website.
Well, the common one is flu-type symptoms. Even a GI bug like nausea or vomiting that's otherwise unexplained, fatigue, muscle aches, sore throat, low grade temperature, and that temperature usually be the equivalent of 100.4 or greater. So a lot of people use those infrared devices that you can get, and it kind of points at your forehead. That's an infrared temperature measuring device. You would need to add a half a degree to adjust up to achieve, to calculate an oral equivalent. So 100.4 is sort of the cutoff for a COVID type temperature. Certainly that's not 100%, but I mean 99.2, people would really consider that a real temperature and real suspicious for COVID. So we kind of look for 100.4 oral equivalent. Those are most of the symptoms, and probably the most profound is loss of a sense of smell or taste. Whenever that happens, they have COVID-19 until proven otherwise, because it's so seldom seen with any other illness, including influenza, that is a high marker. So even if they test negative, I'm still very suspicious and may keep them in isolation and repeat the test again in 2 days, because none of the tests are 100%, much as we'd like them to be. But and we've got three testing platforms. We have the reference laboratory, we have the Abbott ID Now, which is a rapid test, and we just recently got the Binance test antigen kits. You may have heard of those. Those are the ones you can buy over the counter now for about $25 to do a home test on yourself if you wanted to. But we've got all three of those tests, and the reference laboratory is the most sensitive and specific, but it may take 2 to 4 days to get the result back. So meanwhile, you're trying to make decisions about what to advise this patient. You got a 4-day wait. So the rapid tests are helpful when they're positive. If the patient still got suspicious symptoms like I've outlined, we may send the reference test to the reference laboratory and place them in isolation while we're waiting for the confirmatory result.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw, for that. And the reason I asked that question is, like I said, my daughter did not present with the symptoms of, she presented with sinus type of symptoms. And so that's why I assumed that she had a sinus infection.
Okay. Pretty common. I've had a lot of people say, well, my sinuses are full, it's my allergies. And that's a pretty common complaint as well.
Thank you very much. I was just thinking of one more scenario that I was just wondering about. Being that the vaccine takes two doses, so hypothetically, let's say that I present for my vaccine tomorrow. Is there another vaccine attached to it to ensure that I'm going to get my second vaccine? Because and the only reason I ask is because I've been in situations in the healthcare field where we've had to have children come back for a second round of vaccinations, and we didn't have them in stock at the time. And so do you hold on to a second vaccine for our patients when they come in?
Well, right now we are not, because we're so anxious to get primary vaccination started on all of our vulnerable high priority populations. And then also based on the assurance that we will get sufficient vaccine to complete all second injections. Plus the Pfizer, expires much faster than that. You couldn't possibly hold it for 3 weeks. They would all expire. So you're pretty much forced to have to wait on the second shipment for the Pfizer vaccine. Moderna, if once it's thawed, it's good in the refrigerator for 30 days. So theoretically, you could hold those doses back. But if you held, for example, if you vaccinate, say we got the 200 doses and we vaccinated 100, said, well, let's hold 100 back so we're for sure that we've got the second dose available for 28 days from now. Well, that's 100 less people we could start on a vaccination process. So so far we've just been vaccinating with the first injection going forward. But I understand your concern. Every time I think about that, I go, well, I hope IHS is going to come through. Although every time I talk to the chief medical officer from the Oklahoma City area office, he assures me that they're tracking it. They know how many Pfizer's and Moderna's we've given. They will make sure that we have enough for the second shot.
I appreciate that, Dr. Shaw. I agree. We've got to get everybody vaccinated as much as we possibly can. Okay. Committee, is there any more questions or any questions from anybody that's not on the committee? Okay, hearing none, thank you, sir, for all the great information that you passed on to us.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Oh, yes. Congressman Big Horse, you have the floor.
Yeah, just real quick. from everything that I've read and everything that I've heard from Dr. Shaw, it's right in line with the news feeds that I've been watching, and it looks like we're right on. Matter of fact, it looks like we're kind of a step or two ahead of some of the cities and municipalities. So I just wanted to thank Dr. Shaw. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Congressman Big Horse. I agree, Congressman Big Horse. I just know that the clinic here in Fairfax does not have the vaccine, and they don't know when they're going to receive the vaccine, and they are a government entity also. They're a federally qualified health center, so we are fortunate.
This is Terry. Actually, the clinic in Fairfax does have it now. Just letting you know, I got my first dose today.
Ah, I was there yesterday. They said they didn't have it, so thank you so much for that information.
Today to get some more next week.
Fantastic. That's good to hear. Thank you, Terry.
Yeah, no problem.
Madam Chair, this is Cindy.
Yes, ma'am. Ms. Schenger, you have the floor.
I would just like to say I would give the highest praise and thank you to Dr. Shaw and our clinic administration for the rollout that they've done for the COVID testing, for our vaccination plan. And as Congressman Big Horse noted, we seem to be ahead of the curve everywhere we are. And if you have noticed, if you're a friends on Facebook with the Washougie Clinic, every day we see updates on COVID, public service announcements, and I cannot thank the clinic staff enough for everything you've done for the Osage Nation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Shangru. Yes, I hope that all people will follow on social media. There's great information out there for them to garner from our clinic. Okay, the next, anybody have anything else? Okay, great. So now, since I jumped to this earlier, we have the Moss Adams report discussion that we received on September 16th of 2020 in our email. And we haven't had the opportunity to discuss the recommendations, I guess, and the findings. And so when I started, I just was, Ms. Changer, I just wanted to give you the opportunity to, let us just kind of lead us through this and, the idea behind contracting Moss Adams for the reorganization and restructuring.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, for that. I don't have much to report on the Moss Adams issue. Specifically to say, back early in November, Dr. Shaw, who as a supervisor of the Moss Adams contract, had an in-depth discussion with Standing Bear regarding this contract and being dissatisfied with the consultant's performance. So on 11/4/2020, Dr. Shaw terminated that contract with Moss Adams. So the partial study that we got is all that we're going to get. And I will now let Dr. Shaw speak to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shangru, for informing us of that. And so the partial that we do have, because it does say interim on the report, correct? And did everybody receive the report? I just want to assure that everybody did receive the report. Like I said, it came to us on 9/16/2020 in our email. Okay, so Ms. Shanger mentioned a dissatisfaction with the interim report, I guess, is the take on it. I didn't know about that. So, Dr. Shaw, would you like to elaborate?
Okay, Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I originally set up the, in conjunction with procurement, the RFP, because it was, this contract fell under the Competitive Bidding Act. And so an RFP was sent out. There were, I think, a total of three vendors submitted proposals. There was a rating committee appointed. I was one of those, as was, I think, the chair of the health authority at that time. And I think at least one member executive branch reviewed the proposals. And I think there was universal agreement that Moss Adams was the was submitted the best proposal. And what we had asked them to do at the time was to give us an idea what the best structure would be under Osage law, what type of legal changes would we need to be requested of the Congress to achieve any type of relevant reorganization, and also what that reorganization might look like if it were to now include its own human resources, procurement, accounting, and facility management. Because as you know, right now, we depend on those from the Osage Nations, HR, procurement, accounting, and tribal works. And we pay for that with indirect costs. And I know last year our budget was over $2 million for indirect costs. And so we pay a substantial amount for support from those various entities. And so we'd always thought that one of the goals of reorganization is to be able to secure our own support services and actually have better value for what we're paying. Because you can get a lot of services for $2 million. Even in-house. So anyway, that was sort of the direction or thought. Hey, Moss Adams, can you help us give it an idea what that might look like? And I really thought that their proposal that included the help with the legal assessment. But then later on, they kept wanting to have these focus groups with patients. And I thought, well, you know, this is really a business decision here. I'm not sure why they're doing all this. They had interviewed some of the clinic management, I think all the members of the health authority, and really didn't do any primary data gathering. We submitted a lot of documents to them, organizational charts and so forth. And then the chief was going to submit, wanted to submit some legislation to the Congress in early August. That didn't happen because it turned out that we really weren't ready, but he had asked for a interim report from Moss Adams, which is here in front of you. And so that's what came out. I know that the chief was not happy with that report. I know clinic management was not happy with that report. We felt like that there was not enough primary research or evaluation. And we did send a response to that to the health authority. And I think it came yesterday also with the Moss Adams report. So you can, your committee could get a good idea exactly what we objected to about the report. And so, yes, it did mention that clinic management could do better or perhaps were part of a problem. But, you know, the real issue is we got billed $56,000. We got this one interim report and virtually no other product. Never saw a plan to reestablish the or design or implement a structure that had its own accounting and human resources procurement. And I was just shocked about the tens of thousands we're getting billed. So, and we had joint meetings. Then we had to get a contract with a separate law firm at another $100,000 because it turns out that they were not going to do that part of the work. So I became dissatisfied with the work product. I shared that with the chief. We had discussed it. He discussed his own misgivings, and ultimately the decision was made to terminate the contract and to resubmit it for bid, again, being more specific about the designs that we need, that, you know, as a self-operating entity, and not asking them to do any type of legal analysis. There's actually a separate law firm, Sadowski Chambers, et cetera. They are actually doing the legal analysis and proposing the legal structure for this new entity. It's not ready to roll out. It's not been approved yet. There's not been a decision on its final form, but at some point it will be submitted or presented to the Congress or this committee.
You guys,
Did you receive that response? That I think it's called Clinic Moss Adams Clinic Report. It's really, it's from a clinic management that responds to the Moss Adams interim report. So not something I don't expect everyone to read it here at the meeting, but I do want you to know that some weeks or months ago we submitted a response and shared that with executive and the health authority. I don't know that we sent it to your committee till just perhaps yesterday.
Can you guys hear me?
We hear
okay.
You.
Okay, great.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'm thinking something's up here. Okay, so you say there was an email yesterday, possibly, Dr. Shaw. What did it? Who did it come? Who did it come from?
Would it either come from me or Laura Stoney?
Okay. I received the vaccine plan from via Chana, our clerk, from Laura. Committee, do you guys have the...
No, we had sent it to the board in the past. It may be that we didn't send it to the committee yesterday. I'm sorry, I'm kind of hazy. I don't have my email in front of me. Have you never received the Moss Adams report itself?
We do have them. Yes, we received it on 9/16/20 via an email.
Okay. We may not have sent you the response we had. That may have gone only to the health authority and to the executive branch.
Okay.
If you're not finding it, I have to believe that we didn't send it one.
Okay. Anybody else here? Has anybody else here on the call from Congress received correspondence that Dr. Shaw is mentioning?
Congresswoman Lemon, this is the clerk.
Yes, ma'am.
I just checked my emails and I have not received anything of that nature. So it didn't come to me. It would have, if anybody received it, it would have had to have gone to a member of Congress personally.
My apologies, Madam Chair. We'll rectify that, have that sent to the clerk at the earliest opportunity. I'm sorry we don't have that ready for your meeting today. I thought I did, but I didn't.
It's okay. We're all human, sir. We all. That's just fine. We'll be glad to receive it when it gets here. I need just a minute. Apologize there for a moment. Got a frog in my throat or something. Okay. Well, it just depends on where the committee would like to go from this point forth concerning the agenda item. I will take the lead of the committee or any other members of Congress that have any questions, or the floor is open.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Congressman Big Horse, you have the floor.
Yes, for Dr. Shaw. Dr. Shaw, in this Moss Adams interim or whatever kind of report they sent, Is there any value to that at all? Is there anything in it that we can use, I should say?
Well, they made recommendations about we needed to restructure to bring those services into the clinic. Of course, that was already our plan to do anyway, sort of agreed with why we hired them. But they didn't really have anything concrete for how to do that or what that structure would look like. So, be honest with you, I just read it again just now and see very little next to nothing that we could actually use. So that's why I think we need a new consultant to design
it. Follow up?
Yes, sir. Please go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Shaw, and I wholeheartedly agree. this report right here, anybody could sit down that has a medical background and throw this together without doing any interviews or I'm in agreement with you. This is not in depth enough.
Thank you, Mr. Big Horse. Earlier you had mentioned, Mr. Dr. Shaw, that and it does say an interim report. So was there would have been a final report, yes, if the contract hadn't been terminated?
Yeah, there should have been a final report to where they actually give us a description of what the structure would look like. You know, our reorganization that we had in mind was to reorganize the business structure of the clinic to where we had those services in-house. And so that's what we never got, never even saw a description or seen it alluded to. I can't tell you when that was coming. For some reason, they kept wanting to do focus groups with patients to decide what the structure would look like. So I never did really understand that and thought we were actually wasting our time with that. I don't say that lightly because I don't ever think we're wasting time talking to patients. But on this business structure, I think it was for a different purpose than those focus groups would serve.
Were they not willing to amend their plan?
Well, when let me just tell you this: when I made contact or attempted to make contact with the Moss Adams rep, whose title was that he was in charge of health operations, I was told he was no longer with Moss Adams. And so I lost interest at that time and thought it best to terminate.
I see. So he didn't have a backup, I guess, I'm assuming.
Not that I ever heard of. Of course, they wanted us to change our mind, but I just was so, really so disgusted and felt like we were overcharged and overbilled for little or no work product. I felt like we were better off starting over.
You mentioned earlier that they had visited with employees that weren't in administration. How do you feel about that? And are you, I mean, they're the people that are the worker bees that do the daily work. And I know I've been in administration myself at times when I have felt that an idea was a great idea, but I wasn't the one who was actually putting forth the procedure. I mean, putting forth the workings of something and, just like anything, Dr. Shaw, you know as well, in healthcare, we look at something, we assess it, we put down a plan, and we go back and assess it. And so
I didn't object to them talking to the employees or the health authority, but I did get, I was dissatisfied when their report, this interim report, seemed to rely disproportionately heavily on personal interviews rather than primary research. And so I thought, well, they met and just basically regurgitated what they heard in these series of one-on-one meetings, and that was their interim report. So I just didn't think that should be the sole foundation on which to put together an interim report.
I understand that, absolutely. So when was their contract executed, and then when was it to be terminated if it was to go to fruition?
Been the end of this fiscal year would be when it would have been terminated. I don't have that date of when it was executed in front of me. We would have had to renew the contract past the end of this fiscal year. But they had been aboard for well into the last calendar year, and we just never really got much information out of them. So I'm sorry I don't have those exact dates in front of me.
No, that's okay. I around about ballpark would have, that's okay. So you're saying basically that it would have completed on 9/30/20. That would have been the term or the night or 9/30/21.
Or 9/30 or 12/30/20. And we would have had to renew it or extend it.
Because they weren't finished, I guess.
Chair, this is Stabler.
Yes, Ms. Stabler, you have the floor.
You know, I think that we need to focus. I read this as well, and I think that they missed the target completely. The whole point was to determine a restructure of the clinic for legal purposes on how they would be set up as an entity, and not necessarily the inner operations of the clinic. So I understand they were interviewing and gathering data, and you know, all that's well and good, but it seems like they completely missed the target. And you know, even though it was an interim report, there were pages that were just blank, where they didn't even put in a plan for what they thought they were to be working on. So I tend to agree that this was just down the wrong path altogether. You know, we've had ideas and we've had some conversations about what we think that we want to do, but we just didn't know how to get there legally to make this so that it's a protected entity, so that it has the umbrella of the nation and it's still able to operate independently. So that's my thoughts on it. It really did not focus on what was the scope or the task that they were hired to do. Thank you. Just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you, Congress. Thank you, Congresswoman Saylor. The floor is open for any other comments or discussion concerning this last agenda item. Okay, hearing none, I'm going to move on, and the chair will entertain a motion for adjournment.
So moved. This is Stabler.
Second.
There's a motion for adjournment and second. Any discussion? I would just like to thank everyone for being here today and giving the information. And a lot of great information, Dr. Shaw. We appreciate it. Helps me understand where we're at with the vaccine and what we can tell people when they call us. Well, did I hear somebody want to say something? Okay, I guess not. I apologize there. And hopefully the next contract will be executed and we'll get what we want, what we pay for next time, hopefully, concerning the reorganization of the clinic. With nothing further, all those in favor of adjourning?
Yes. Aye.
Yes.
I hear no opposed. We are adjourned. Thank you all for your time today.
Bye, everybody. Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.
Happy New Year, everybody.